Governor Bill Clinton, met with the Irish American community in New York and promised to appoint a special envoy to Northern Ireland to begin to broker a peace process. It was a bold and unprecedented initiative because the British government had always considered the troubles in Northern Ireland between Catholics and Protestants as an internal conflict, and many skeptics argued that it could change the special relationship between the U.S. and the United Kingdom. Nevertheless, President Clinton kept his promise. The man from Hope recruited the man from Maine, Senator George Mitchell, who is here with us tonight. With President Clinton's constant encouragement and direct engagement, the Good Friday Agreement was signed in Belfast on April 10, 1998. On Good Friday. Ladies and gentlemen, let's take a moment and go back to that time.
I'm very hopeful that the British and the Irish governments will get back together and begin a serious dialogue soon. I think that is a precondition, as I said, for the other talks proceeding. My discussions with Prime Minister Reynolds, as with Prime Minister Major, were the first of many that I think you will see our governments having as we offer our assistance in trying to end the troubles.
In 1995, President Clinton appointed Senator George Mitchell as United States Special Envoy for Northern Ireland to serve as chairman of the peace talks between the Irish and British governments.
It doesn't take courage to shoot a policeman in the back of the head or to murder an unarmed taxi driver. What takes courage is to compete in the arena of democracy, as these men and women are here tonight, where the tools are persuasion, fairness, and common sense.
Good evening. A historic day at Stormont. After 2 years of talks and after a generation of bloodshed and decades of division and acrimony, George Mitchell ushers in what the whole island hopes will be a new era of peace, an agreement that unites loyalists and republicans, unionists and nationalist leaders in a wide-ranging historical accord.
The two prime ministers emerged just before six this evening to inaugurate the historic agreement they hope will usher in a new era for the island.
After a 30-year winter of sectarian violence, Northern Ireland today has the promise of a springtime of peace. The agreement that has emerged from the Northern Ireland peace talks opens the way for the people there to build a society based on enduring peace, justice, and equality.
so ridiculous.
For 30 long years, the troubles took a terrible toll. Too many died, too many families grieved. Every family was denied the quiet blessings of a normal life. In the constant fear that a simple trip to the store could be devastated by bombs and bullets. In the daily disruptions of roadblocks and searches. In the ominous presence of armed soldiers always on patrol. In neighborhoods demarcated by barbed wire, guarded gates, and 20-foot fences. No wonder this question was painted on the Belfast wall. Is there life before death? Now at last, your answer is yes. The United States has supported your quest for peace, starting with Irish Americans, whose commitment to this cause is passionate, profound, and enduring. It has been one of the great privileges of my presidency to work with the peacemakers, Protestant and Catholic leaders here in the North, Prime Minister Blair and Prime Minister Ahern. And so, members of the Assembly, citizens of Belfast, people of Northern Ireland, remember that in the early days of the American Republic, the Gaelic term for America was Inishmore, Island of Destiny. Today, Americans see you as Inishmore, and your destiny is peace. America is with you. The entire world is with you. May God be with you and give you strength for the good work ahead. Thank you very much. I thank all the performers and
those who will sing and read the words of the Irish and Irish Americans. I thank especially a longtime friend of Hillary's and mine, Judy Collins, for her contribution, which includes a song that sings on God as a name. And I want to thank you for selecting the things that you want us to hear. When Hillary read The Second Coming, when I was mouthing the word along with her, I thought of a funny thing that happened in 1995 when we had 100,000 happy Irish in the streets in Dublin. And Bono and U2 were there. And we were waiting back in the old Bank of Ireland building. And Bono, with typical understatement, gave me a 1938 edition of William Butler Yeats' plays, autographed by Yeats, and then signed by Bono. It says, as God is my witness, it says, Bill and Hillary. This guy wrote some good lines too. And so he did. I have often asked myself, and my daughter wrote a college paper on it, how I got so wrapped up in the Irish. My mother's family came from the north. We have the oldest documented Cassidy homestead is in Roslyn County, Vermont. I have two paintings of it and an old glass bottle taken out of what remains inside the house. It's on our mantelpiece at home. I have always been captivated by the physical beauty, by the stunning effect of the Irish language on any listening ear, and of course the music, the drama, the poetry, the prose. So I am especially grateful to the Irish Repertory Theater for bringing those gifts to America for 30 years. You've come a long way from Sean O'Casey's The Plow and the Stars. I thank you. Tonight, as Hillary said, we know that the Second Coming is particularly important because of the challenges our Irish friends are facing because of Brexit and the inability to stand up a government because of the uncertainty of what the consequences will be. So I ask you to think about what this night is about. The arts are the great gift we give to our better selves. They fill our hearts with emotions, they fill our heads with ideas, they fill our imagination with possibilities. Last year, on the eve of the 20th anniversary of the Good Friday Accord, I borrowed a quote from Seamus Heaney's Nobel Prize speech about Yeats in Dublin. He said, referring to Yeats, his intent was the clearest space in the mind and in the world for the miraculous. That's what the Irish peace process did. It cleared a space for the miraculous. It all started in April of 1992 when, leading up to the Democratic primary here in New York, about 100 Irish Americans invited all the candidates to show up, and so I did. I tried to be well briefed, and I was told that they would ask me to appoint a special envoy, and I should be sympathetic but not do it. because it was a commitment I might not be able to keep, and if I did, I would infuriate the British and peril the special election, you know, yada, 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 you know that. I said I would. I did find it hard to keep the commitment, but I did. And embarked upon one of the most extraordinary journeys of my life. When my daughter Chelsea was graduating from Stanford in 2000, she wrote her honors thesis on the Irish in America. And the last part was about the Irish peace talks, and I said, how'd that come out? She said, well, Dad, I think when you started, you just wondered when the New York primary. But when you got into it, you realized how important it was. There was some truth in that, but it was also true that I was in Oxford as a student when the troubles began. The first place I went outside of England as a student was to Dublin. I always wondered why this had all happened and whether it could be changed. There are many people to whom I am in great debt, but none more than a person who's here tonight, the man who brokered the Irish peace, George Mitchell, and I thank him. About what was in it and how it applies to where we are. What did they agree to do? They agreed on majority rule, but minority rights. Knowing that given the shifting birth rates, one day the Catholic Republicans would outnumber the Protestant unions. And knowing that, given the growth of the Irish economy, if it spread to Northern Ireland, the inflow of immigrants might keep anybody from having a majority. So they enshrined individual rights and shared political participation and shared economic benefits and shared relationships with both the United Kingdom and the Irish Republic. It was a great idea. And it is imperiled by Brexit because nobody knows what the border will be and nobody knows for sure what the consequences will be. And the Northern Irish voters voted to remain in the EU for good reasons. Among them, 87% of all the farm supports that Irish farmers get come from the EU, not from the UK. The whole thing is a mess, but you should not despair, because there has been no return to violence. There's still plenty of cranes up in Belfast doing their work. Everybody wants to build a future. The two biggest parties are almost evenly divided in the parliament, and they can't make a national unity deal until they know what the terms of Brexit are. So we are now, once again, in a questioning vacuum. And once again, we need to see it as space for the miraculous. The people like their peace. They want their children to be prosperous and free. It is interesting, isn't it, that a region that had been racked for so long by identity politics is trying to convince their English and Welsh neighbors not to be lured by the false siren song of identity politics. Still, the Irish themselves would also admit they made enough mistakes in the past that they can afford to be a little bit patient with their neighbors. And so we labor on. Just remember, every time you sing an Irish song, every time you read an Irish line, every time you cheer an Irish performer, now every time you say, "How about the ferryman winning the Tony?" That there are no permanent victories and no permanent defeats in public affairs. Earlier today, at my foundation, the wonderful Irish artist Colin Davidson presented me with a very large portrait. Consul General was there. My friend Dennis O'Brien, a lot of us and a lot of leaders of the American Irish community were there. And it wasn't your standard, there's Bill Clinton telling you everything's going to be hunky-dory. I look like an aging Yates with downcast eyes, thought and thought. Because I do, in some moments, worry about the future of my country and of Ireland and Northern Ireland. Because the world has heard this old song about our differences being all that matters a lot of times, going all the way back to prehistory when there was no Irish barn to capture the music of the moment. And we are here tonight in this magnificent theater because drip by drip, wisdom has crept in and told us no. We can be who we are, we can be proud of who we are, and still extend our embrace. As important and interesting as our differences are, our common humanity does matter more. In the end, that is the source of the undying appeal of and yearning for the arts. And the reason I'm so honored with this recognition tonight. I did my best, and even though I have no power, I still do my best. That is all we can do. But remember, Seamus Heaney was right. We all have to clear our space for the miraculous. Then we do whatever we can, large or small, to remember that possibility is more important than pessimism. That love is better than hate. And ideas about how we can go forward are far better than constant resentment. Everywhere in the world, people seem determined to repeat the saga of the Irish struggles. Let the Irish lead the world away from it. Thank you.